We would soon be ready for the Predator to start mapping targets in Afghanistan. Getting the airframe had been relatively easy. Nobody wanted it. Figuring out how to build and manage an interagency team to fly the Predator over Afghanistan was a monumental technical, operational, and leadership challenge. Clark, Allen, Frey, and Kofor pushed at the top. In counterpoint to Clark's bombastic bullying, his deputy, Roger Cressy, played a useful role as a quiet facilitator. Meanwhile, Rich and Alec reached out to like-minded allies at the GS-14 and lieutenant colonel levels throughout the national security community. Although the core task and leadership fell to CTC, more than a dozen U.S. government agencies played essential roles, forming an ad hoc task force. It's remarkable that Rich and Alec managed this with no memorandums of agreement except with the Air Force. They forged a trusted network that cut across the U.S. intelligence and security establishment. The NSC gave CIA the writ. The Joint Staff provided political horsepower and connectivity throughout DOD. The Air Force had the technology. DIA contributed analysts. National Imagery and Mapping Agency, NIMA, helped with the geospatial analysis and exploitation. CENTCOM provided a liaison officer for coordination. Various agencies provided mission managers. And CTC scrounged collection managers from all parts of the CIA. A gnarly issue was satellite bandwidth. It was scarce, expensive, and essential. In the beginning, Kofor and I seemed to spend more time on this topic than any other. We also had to secure and maintain a base in Uzbekistan. Meanwhile, Rich and Alec led the diverse interagency team, including contractors. Because we had developed a dynamic network throughout Afghanistan, our HUMINT, complemented by SIGINT and IMINT, was very good. We knew the enemy. We knew where to look, where to send the Predator. This was critical because of the camera's narrow field of vision. The magnification was outstanding. NIMA analysts could identify the make and model of vehicles and gauge the height of individuals. The picture was clear and steady. The optics responded on command, swiveling and zooming as directed. For the most part, the bird was quiet enough and so small and flew at such high altitudes that only under unique circumstances could people on the ground identify any intrusion. Within weeks, the Predator was working beyond our expectations. We quickly accumulated hours of video data on target sites, vehicles, and patterns of movement of the enemy inside Afghanistan. We crunched all source reporting to refine all points of collection. All sources, particularly HUMINT, informed Predator operators. In turn, the Predator helped verify and improve the requirements for other sources, including HUMINT. The synergy proved itself on one bright summer's day over Tarnak Farms near Kandahar. We all gathered around Rich's Predator team, watching the live video feed on the big screen. Our HUMINT sources had reported that UBL would be at the site in that time frame. We had wanted to deploy our indigenous covert action team to interdict and capture or kill UBL, but the legal and operational doubts persisted, and we could not secure our leadership's approval. But this time we had a Predator circling and its video stream pouring onto our screen. We knew this was an AQ facility. We had high hopes as a small convoy of trucks approached the compound. The signature of the security detail leaped out at us. The principal's vehicle stopped, and a tall man dressed in white exited. This was UBL. We watched as he walked into the courtyard of the large compound. Several supplicants scurried to greet him. He acknowledged them briefly but kept walking. The sky was clear, the image excellent. No women or children. We had him. "Holy Mother of God," somebody said. "Not quite," somebody else responded.
"That's him! That's UBL," another cried.
He was in the frame for several long seconds before he entered a thickly walled interior building. The analysts scrambled to alert the White House and DOD. It would take at least 6 hours for the cruise missiles, launched from U.S. Navy ships in the Indian Ocean, to reach the target. The White House decided that was too long. They demanded to know if UBL would be there for another 6 hours or more. We did not know. Unsatisfactory. No cruise missiles. We couldn't believe it. Cofer and Rich briefed the White House. Clark and Allen were as miffed as all of us, but there would be no change of White House expectation. CTC would have to predict UBL's location into the future, or find a way to engage the target within seconds, not hours. We had bin Laden in our electrical-optical sights, but we had no realistic policy, no clear authority, and no meaningful resources to engage the target with lethal speed and precision. It was all sadly absurd. In 1999 and 2000, Rich and his team labored to produce exact and verifiable intelligence on the location of senior AQ targets in Afghanistan, so policymakers could give us the green light to kill them. Our expanding HUMINT networks continued to produce good intelligence inside Afghanistan, including sporadic but accurate insight into bin Laden's location. There were half a dozen decent opportunities to pinpoint him, but there was no absolute verification. Our intelligence was from local sources, and the White House doubted their credibility. One half-hearted attempt by local allies to ambush bin Laden created more controversy than encouragement. Our CIA leadership and the White House wanted more clarity, more assurance, more quality control, and far less risk. Now, even with such clarity, the Clinton administration still took no action. The risk, I was learning, revolved more around politics than operations. Lethal covert action can carry ugly political consequences, as history attests. I understood that, but it seemed that this threat far outweighed the risks we had taken. To our frustration in CTC, the president's covert action finding included many caveats, e.g., we could only seek to kill UBL if it was part of a capture operation. Yet there was no apparent problem killing him with a cruise missile. This was silly. UBL had declared war on the United States by word and deed. He had partially destroyed our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in August 1998 with truck bombs. He had attacked the USS Cole in October 2000. He had planned to kill thousands at the turn of the century, but CTC, working with dozens of CIA stations and our Foreign Intelligence Service partners, had thwarted him. Bin Laden supported affiliated groups, all with terrorist intent and capabilities. How many people would he need to kill before we appreciated the threat? I wondered if President Clinton and his advisors naively viewed this as a law enforcement matter rather than war. I wondered how much of the parsed language in the finding was designed to protect their political reputations rather than protect the nation. Given my inexperience in Washington, D.C., I did not have a feel for this dynamic. Cofer told me repeatedly that he would take care of the politics and I should take care of the operations. I followed his orders, but nevertheless remained perplexed by the strategic policy context and frustrated by the consequential operational limitations. Rich and his team, focused exclusively on AQ, were even more frustrated. Rich kept telling me that AQ would attack us again. Rich stressed almost daily that we needed to do more. I again talked with Cofer about sending U.S. Special Forces and CIA commando teams deep into Afghanistan to engage AQ. This would allow us to gather more accurate, verifiable, and sustained intelligence. Such a deployment, of course, would also give us the means to work with our Afghan partners to target UBL with lethal force. These deployments, primarily intelligence collection missions, could easily be expanded and reinforced for direct U.S. commando engagement with the enemy. We could now justify this, I argued, because we had the Predator as an intelligence platform to support our on-the-ground mission. Kofor, with a mix of exasperation and patience, explained to me that this would not happen. There was insufficient political will. The risk was too high from a public political perspective. Imagine the pre-9/11 headlines, CIA assassinates Saudi militant in Afghanistan. I slowly began to understand that even if we had verifiable, pinpoint accuracy regarding bin Laden's location, there was no assurance of a lethal strike. I realized that arming the Predator was perhaps our only chance of achieving our lethal mission. Clark, Allen, and Kofor pushed for this hard. The bureaucratic fight was nasty. Many were resistant to the notion that the CIA should have such lethal capability and authority. Pavitt was adamantly opposed, believing that the political danger to the CIA far outweighed the